This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Stephen Sondheim's 1971 musical Follies is back on Broadway, and the cast recording was just released this week. Our first guest is one of the show's stars, Danny Burstein. Burstein was also in the recent revival of South Pacific, which was shown on public television. His performance earned a 2008 Tony nomination for Best Featured Actor in a Musical. In 2006, he was nominated for a Tony for his performance in The Drowsy Chaperone. He also plays a casino owner in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Terry spoke with Burstein last week. Follies is set in an old theater that's about to be torn down, where there's a reunion of the showgirls who used to perform there decades ago in a Ziegfeld Follies-type review. The girls have brought their husbands to the reunion, and the show shifts back and forth between the present and the past when the girls were young and performing in the Follies. Danny Burstein plays a salesman, Buddy, married to a former showgirl played by Bernadette Peters. Let's start with Danny Burstein and Ron Raines singing Waiting for the Girls Upstairs, in which they remember when they first started dating the showgirls who became their wives. Burstein sings first.
Hey, up there, way up there, what do you say up there?
I see it all. It's like a movie in my head that plays and plays. It isn't just the bad things I remember. It's the whole damn show.
Waiting around for the girls upstairs after the curtain came down. Money in my pocket to spend. Honey, could you maybe get a friend for my friend?
Hearing the sound of the girls above, dressing to go on the town.
Clicking heels on steel and cement.
Picking up the giggles floating down through the vent.
Goddamnedest hours that I ever spent. We're waiting for the girls upstairs.
That's Danny Burstein with Ron Raines from the new cast recording of Follies. Danny Burstein, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I really enjoyed your performance in Follies.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Follies is such a famous show, and yet you'd never seen it before. So people are probably arriving, comparing it to the original production and to revivals and to the cast recording. How did it feel to you when you were cast and you'd never seen a production and you had to kind of start from scratch?
Well, the one thing I did know is that everybody had an opinion about the show, and they were all different. And everybody's opinion was very, very strong. And it was good because I had my own opportunity to form my own opinion about it without knowing anything about it beforehand. So I got the script, and I just kept reading it over and over and over again, first for enjoyment, and then I tried to start to make decisions about the characters and my character's arc, which was very important to me, and tried to make it as smart as possible. I have this weird thing that I do. I sort of, every character I play, I try to make that guy the smartest guy in the room. And I try to figure out how to do that with the character of Buddy Plummer. And it wasn't easy at first.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I've seen a production of Follies in which it was a great production, but Buddy was played kind of like a real loser. And you don't play him that way. You play him as a decent guy whose life hasn't turned out the way he would have wanted it to. And he's in a marriage that's not really working out, and he has a girlfriend who really isn't that smart. And
Well, he's got normal ideals, understandable ideals, universal ideals. He just wants to be in a happy marriage, and he wants to have a normal type of life. But unfortunately, his wife of almost 30 years has not requited his love. And she's been in love with somebody else all that time. And she's grown sadder and sadder over the years. But he still has this pipe dream that their love will somehow be all right. And the marriage will be all right, even though it probably won't.
Was it a conscious decision for you not to play Buddy as a loser?
Absolutely. I have a... It's sort of a pet peeve of mine. I don't like whiners, characters who whine on stage. And I tried to, in reading the script, that's what it seemed like to me, like the character was one sad sack whiner. And I thought, no, he really wants something. He wants the love of his wife. And so he's fighting for that. And so lines that could be read, you know, in a very sad way, instead could be also read in a very positive way, in really wanting something from his wife. And not just complaining about how bad life is, but telling her about it so there can be change, so they can move forward.
Can you give me an example of a line that could be read as sad that you've made it as kind of, you know, these are guys who
want something. It's so funny you said that because I can't think of a single one at this moment.
Thanks for coming through for us.
I know. It's really great to be here, Terry. Take care.
Okay, well, let's bail ourselves out with a song, because there's a great song called The Right Girl. And you explain the context of the song.
The Right Girl happens at the top of Act Two. He's just watched his wife, Sally, kiss his old best friend. And they've told each other that they love each other. And she even wants to marry him. And I watch this scene happen, and the right girl occurs right after that.
And you're singing in part about your girlfriend, your mistress.
Yes. In the middle of the song, he sings about his mistress, Margie, and thinks that she is the right girl that he should marry. And then at the end of the song, he realizes that he doesn't love his mistress and he doesn't love his wife of 30 years, who he's so convinced himself he loves all these years, and he finally is able to let her go at the end of the song.
It's a great song, and you do it so well. So this is Stephen Sondheim's song, The Right Girl, sung by Danny Burstein in the new cast recording of Follies.
The Right Girl. She makes you feel like $1 million instead of what, like a rented tux. The right girl, yeah, the right girl. She's with you no matter how you feel. You're not the good guy, you're not the heel. You're not the dream boat that sank your reel. When you got the right, and I got.
So that was Danny Burstein singing The Right Girl from the new cast recording of the Stephen Sondheim musical Follies. Now, you know, the yeah that you do in that, when you've got yeah, the right girl, that's such a loaded yeah, because it sounds so affirmative and you're in such kind of doubt and kind of despair in the song. And also musically, it's like real powerful punctuation. Yeah. So when you were figuring out how to do the song, did you spend a lot of time figuring out how to do the yeah?
Oh, endlessly. It is famously a very, very difficult song for actors to do. And one thing I had to do initially was separate who I was talking to. And so I put the character of Sally off stage left, where Bernadette has just exited.
And she's your wife.
And she plays my
wife. In this loveless marriage.
Yes. And then the character of Margie I put out center. So my love for Margie, you know, is focused towards the audience, and my anger is focused off stage left. So that was a huge, actually, it sounds simple, but that was a huge epiphany for me, figuring out who I was talking to in the song, because it's not always clear. And then the yeahs punctuate whether you feel ecstatic and elated and all this love for Margie, or you feel anger and disappointment towards Sally, your wife who doesn't love you. It was very, very difficult figuring out which yeah worked where. It's a very hard song, and we tried many different versions of it. Steve had us cut it in half at first and take a lot of the dance music out, and then we put all of it back in, and then cut some of the dance music down, and then he changed the lyric at the very end.
He changed the lyric? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, he brought in a lyric that he had originally put in London. You miss me? I knew it. Hey, Margie, I blew it. I don't love the right girl. That wasn't in the script when we first started in D.C. I don't even remember what the old lyric was. But that's what we have now. And he told me when his next printing of Finishing the Hat comes out that that's the lyric that's going to be in there.
Really? I know the song, and I didn't realize that the lyric had been changed. I feel foolish. But,
no.
But that's a really great part of it. Actually, let's hear you sing that part.
Okay.
Hey, Margie, I'm back, babe. Come help me unpack, babe. Hey, Margie, hey, bright girl, I'm home. You miss me, I knew it. Hey, Margie, I blew it. I don't love the right girl.
Sally, I want to talk.
That's a great part of the song because it ends on such a kind of tragic note. You've got no place to turn now. You realize
no.
You don't love your wife or your mistress.
And the song gets no applause at the end of it on purpose. That was a choice that Steve gave me. He said, well, we could put a button on the song right there and ask for applause, or we could go straight into the scene. And I had wanted all along to go straight into the scene. It's not... It was never
meant...
Oh,
that's why the scene's on the cast recording, too.
Yeah. It was never meant to open Act 2. When the show was originally played, it was played without an intermission. And so having that onus on it is... It's not fair to the song, in a way. So I thought it would be better just to go right from the song. He has this epiphany that he doesn't actually love his wife anymore. After all that they've been through, he doesn't love her. And so now he can tell her. And that's why the scene that follows is in there. And it's only after he sings that song and he has that revelation that he can actually tell his wife that it's over.
So when you say Sondheim said, well, I could put a button at the end, what does that mean?
That means literally a musical button that asks for the applause at the end of a song. So it could be when I love the right girl, boom, that musical boom is a button. And it basically tells the audience it's okay to applaud.
One of Burstein's songs is the showstopper, The God, Why Don't You Love Me Blues, also known as Buddy's Blues. Terry asked him what was so hard about performing that number.
Dancing and singing at the same time, because the song is relentless. It just continues on and on and on. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, some more nights than not, you know that feeling where you run out of breath and you feel the dark curtains coming? sometimes that happens to me during that number.
Wow.
You know, because you're just putting everything you have into it and singing on top of all the movement. And, you know, you just make it through the number. And it's that exhilarating feeling when you finish it. You know, I used to dread doing it because it's so hard. The lyrics, getting every lyric as clear as possible out there and getting the emotions out there at the same time. But now it is, I look at it like this fantastic challenge. And I really, get myself up for it every single night. It's so exciting.
Yeah, you have to enunciate clearly lyrics that are sung very fast.
Very fast. And each line is its own joke. So, you know, is its own little story. And that was very important to Steve that I, you know, make sure I got all those little jokes and stories out. Because each of them is so unbelievably smart.
So before we hear you singing the Buddy's Blues, what advice did Sondheim give you about this song?
Basically, just to make it as clear and specific as possible. Line by line, just going, I've got those God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do, I'll see you later, blues. So make sure each of those lines is as specific as possible. Know where, you know, the line seems like it's going straight ahead, and then you sort of want it to take a right, and it takes a left.
Yeah, no, that line that you just mentioned, oh, God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do, I'll see you later, blues.
Right.
You're singing this to two separate women, your wife who doesn't love you, and your mistress who does, but who you're always leaving.
Right.
So that line is sung, half of it sung to your wife, and the other half of the line is sung to your mistress, the way I hear it.
Correct.
So you have to make that clear when you're singing it. Kind of like with the song you were talking about before, you have to know who you're addressing in each part of the song.
Exactly. And, of course, it goes at a breakneck speed.
Right. Okay.
So, and you're dancing and doing vaudeville moves.
Right. Okay, so we got to hear it now.
Okay, wonderful.
So this is Buddy's Blues, sung by my guest Danny Burstein from the new cast recording of Follies.
I've got those. God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do. I'll see you later. Blues. That long as you ignore me, you're the only thing that matters. Feeling that if I'm good enough for you, you're not good enough. And thank you for the present, but what's wrong with it, stuff? Those don't come any closer, cause you know how much I love you. Feelings. Those tell me that you love me. Oh, you did. I gotta run now. Blues. Margie. Margie, 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 Margie. She says she really loves me.
I love you.
She says she really cares.
I care. She
says that I'm her hero.
My hero.
She says I'm perfect, she swears.
You're perfect, goddammit.
She says that if we parted.
So you've told us a little bit of the advice that Stephen Sondheim gave you. It sounds like he was very active in this production. Were there questions that you had about the melodies or the lyrics that you were grateful you were able to directly ask Sondheim about?
Yeah, I said, his lyrics, you expect them to take a right and they take a left. He does that with melodies as well. And actually, when you're learning the music, here's the truth. When you're learning the music, and I'm sure I can speak for every actor who's learned a Sondheim song, you're secretly cursing Steve Sondheim because it's so damn hard to learn his music. It takes a left when you naturally want to take a right, melodically. But you realize the music, it doesn't go to a natural note. It goes to, it's not an E natural, it goes to an E flat. And the reason it's an E flat is because he's feeling something that's just off at that moment. If I could just go back to Buddy's Blues, I've got those, God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do, I'll see you later, blues. You know, you don't want to sing that. You just don't, that, God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do, I'll see you later, blues. That long as you ignore me, you're the only thing that matters. Feeling. It's those notes there that tell you something's wrong. Matters, feeling. That lets you know, that's an indicator, that's a stop sign that says, whoa. Even though it's going at a breakneck speed, you know something's not quite right.
So you've been in 3 Broadway or off-Broadway Sondheim musicals. Company, Merrily We Roll Along, and now Follies.
Right.
But the first time you did Merrily We Roll Along was a local production when you were in your teens.
Yeah, I was in college. I was 18, and I was going to Queens College, and my professor, Ed Greenberg, a wonderful director and professor in his own right, he was directing Merrily We Roll Along at Queens College and cast me as Frank in that production.
And this is Franklin Shepard, who's the leading character, and he's a songwriter who starts off with really pure ambitions and becomes more like cynical and commercial as time goes on. But the story is kind of told chronologically in reverse order.
Exactly right.
So I read this. Tell me if it's true that when you were in this college production, you actually wrote Sondheim and asked him for some advice.
I did. I wrote him a long letter, a very, very long letter.
What did you say in this letter?
Oh, God, I asked him all the questions about the show, how it came to be, and what the key to playing his character was, and so many questions. And he wrote me a letter back saying, all these questions, my goodness, you know, I'd have to write a letter the size of War and Peace. I simply don't have the time for that right now. But here's my phone number. Why don't you call me and maybe we can figure out a time that you can come over and we can talk about the show. And I couldn't believe that I had this letter in my hand and that he'd given me his home phone number. And so I called him. I was unbelievably nervous and shaky on the phone, 18-year-old kid, talking to Stephen Sondheim. And he said, yeah, great. In 2 weeks on this day at 3 o'clock, we'll meet. Great. You know, and he hung up and he gave me his address. And sure enough, I walked in and Jim Lapine was just walking out as they were working on Sunday in the Park with George at the time. And we sat there in his living room with a carafe of white wine for 3 hours talking about musical theater. And, you know, that was quite an introduction to me about what it means to give back. And I've been trying to do similar kinds of things my whole life because I had the best example.
So finally, what's your best remedy for a sore throat, an overused throat, when you have to sing?
Gosh, you know what I do? I just drink a lot of hot water and honey. I drink about, I'm not kidding, easily close to a gallon a show of hot water and honey.
But here's what I'm wondering. If you're drinking a gallon of water, unless you're really like sweating it out of your system, which you might very well be in a show like Follies,
yeah,
you must have to use the men's room a lot during a production, and you can't afford to be worrying about that if you're on stage.
You do. Actually, this is the real down and dirty of an actor's life. You have to time out your pees. That's absolutely true. You have to know, you know, oh, okay, between this scene and this scene, I have 7 minutes. So I have the time to run to the downstairs bathroom and then be, and then get back on stage for that next scene. And everybody does it. Nobody really talks about it, but everybody does it because you have to be, you know, overly hydrated in order to do what you do. And of course, you know, we all sweat like crazy. And by the end of the show, you've really, you know, lost a lot of weight, I'm sure.
Well, Danny Burson, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry. I absolutely love you. I'm such a huge fan.
Danny Burstein speaking with Terry Gross. Burstein plays Buddy in the Broadway revival of Stephen Sondheim's Follies. The new cast recording was just released this week. These days, Buck Owens is best known as the smiling country singer who co-hosted the TV show Hee Haw for more than a decade. Starting in the 1960s, he had a string of hit singles on Capitol Records, including Act Naturally, which was covered by the Beatles. But a new collection, Buck Owens Bound for Bakersfield, goes back to the 50s, when Owens was trying out different styles before settling into stardom. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
You'll find me hanging around. It's there I'll be found, down on the corner of love. Neath the stars that shine and the neon signs, I'll be down on the corner of love.
I'm not much for collections of alternate takes and the early music of people who went on to have hits. There's usually a reason a song doesn't become a hit, or to record another take. It's because the music is usually lousy. But I'm a little bit obsessed with this collection of Buck Owens' performances from the years before he became a star. Because of the range of styles he tackled, and how fitfully terrific he was in trying out these poses until he found the one that made him a commercial success. First, to remind you of the sound of that success, here's a little bit from one of his 21 number one hit singles, the mature Capitol Records Buck on 1963's Love's Gonna Live Here.
Oh, the sun's gonna shine in my life once more. Love's gonna live here again. Things are gonna be the way they were before. Love's gonna live here again.
Okay, now let's go back to the 1950s. Owens is in his mid-20s. He's in Bakersfield, California, which had a lively music scene. It was nowhere close to being a music company town like Nashville. Bakersfield was a place in which Buck could play his Telecaster guitar in various bands and begin to take lead vocals. He sounded like this.
The house my family lives in, just down the block. Many times I've passed there, but I never stopped. I go all alone, wishing I could be in that house down the block with my family.
On this album, the carefully but exhaustively titled Bound for Bakersfield 1953 to 1956, The Complete Pre-Capital Collection, Owens is trying out different voices, different genres. He's influenced by Hank Williams, of course, but also the honky-tonk dance music of Bob Wills and the rockabilly of Elvis Presley and Carl Perkins. You can hear this latter influence on a jumping little number like Hot Dog. Oh, and Buck used a different name for his rockabilly move. This one was released under the name Corky Jones.
My baby works in a hot dog stand, making them hot dogs as fast as she can. Upstairs the cat yells, don't be slow, give me two hot dogs right at the go. Hot dog! She's my baby, hot dog! Driving crazy, hot dog! Don't be mean, you oughta see my baby at the hot dog stand.
Sometimes the experiments failed, as the experiments will. Owens was straining for a bluesy Elvis wail his vocal instrument just wouldn't allow him to achieve in a lovable bummer called I'm Gonna Blow. Indeed.
Well, now yonder comes my baby, a-walking down the street. Yeah, yonder comes my baby, and oh, she looks sweet. And that ain't right, no, 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 that ain't right, no, 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 no. I'm gonna pack my things in this old town, I'm gonna blow.
But Buck was growing by leaps and bounds with, it can sometimes seem here, every take of a song. I'm going to play the opening moments of two versions of one 1955 tune, one he wrote called Right After the Dance. On the first, Owen sounds like an eager young buck, jaunty and anxious to get on with the lovemaking and, by extension, his career.
Well, I would if I could, and if I got the chance, make love to you right after the dance. We'll park by the river underneath the moon. On my old guitar, I'll play you a tune. Things will be
now right. Listen to the finished version. A piano has been brought up front. The tempo is slightly slowed to allow for Buck to sing with more tantalizing longing. He's taken a leap in confidence, singing with an open throat of assertiveness. What goes on after this dance is probably going to make his partner happier than she might have been with the anxious guy from the previous version.
Well, I would if I could, and if I got the chance, make love to you right after the dance. We'll park by the river underneath the moon. On my old guitar, I'll play you a tune. Well,
for me, the high point of this collection is a song called There Goes My Love. Released on Pep Records to resounding indifference, There Goes My Love is a wonderfully simple yet emotionally complex song. A lamentation of regret for the one that got away, it's Buck Owens glimpsing on the street the first girl he fell in love with. Rather than indulge in youthful arrogance and dismiss her as someone who doesn't know what she missed, he spends the brief length of the song listing the specific things he misses most, the arms that held him tight, the lips he used to kiss goodnight. With a pedal steel guitar keening behind him, Buck's voice rises up to meet the challenge of the sadness he wants to convey.
There goes the girl I used to know, there goes the girl that I love so, there goes the arms that used to hold me tight. There goes the reason that I sigh, there goes the reason that I cry, there goes the lips I used to kiss goodnight. There goes my love.
Soon enough, Buck Owens would become the sensation of California country music, moving back and forth between Bakersfield and Hollywood to record hit after hit after hit. But before that happened, we're lucky to have this documentation of his diligent work habits, the restless ambition that would eventually yield a sound as distinctive as any in country music history.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Buck Owens' Bound for Bakersfield. In the future, computers may be able to interface with your mind. Cars may drive themselves. Scientists may be able to grow kidneys and other organs. Our next guest, Michio Kaku, has written a new book about scientific innovations in the works based on rapid advances in computers, biotechnology, and artificial intelligence. It's called Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Kaku is a quantum physicist who describes his work as grappling with the equations that govern the subatomic particles out of which the universe is created. He also co-founded string field theory. Kaku is a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York. One of his previous books, Physics of the Impossible, was the basis of the Science Channel TV show Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible. Terry spoke with Kaku last week.
Michio Kaku, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's look at some of the inventions you think might be ready for use within the next 30 years. Why don't we start with internet contact lenses?
That's right. The rate at which we are miniaturizing the internet, it'll be inside our contact lens. So you blink and you go online. If you talk to somebody, you'll see their biography appear right next to their name. And if they speak Chinese to you, you'll see instantaneous translation of Chinese into English. Now, of course, the first people to buy these contact lenses will be college students studying for final examinations. They will simply blink and see all the exam questions right in their contact lens. The next people to buy these things would be
Won't they see all the answers, too? These contact lenses are so great.
Yes, I'm a professor, and it means that we have to change the way we grill our students. No longer long strips of memorization, but concepts and principles have to be stressed. And people who are looking for a job will also buy these contact lenses. In a cocktail party, you will know exactly who to suck up to at any cocktail party. You'll have a complete readout of who they are. And actors and actresses, they'll never flub a line. They'll simply see all their lines right inside their contact lens. Now, these things already exist in some form. I work for the Discovery Channel, the Science Channel sometimes, hosting their documentaries. And I took a film crew down to Fort Benning, Georgia, to look at the military's version of these internet lenses. You place it on your helmet. It's a tiny lens. You flip it down, and immediately you see the internet of the battlefield. Enemy forces, friendly forces, artillery, armor, aircraft, all of it right inside your eyeball.
How can you extrapolate everything that you did from what the military is using now? You know, that actors will use it to act, and that we'll go to a cocktail party and see everybody's biography when we meet them.
Well, I'm a physicist, and we have something called Moore's Law, which says the computer power doubles every 18 months. So every Christmas, we more or less assume that our toys and appliances are more or less twice as powerful as the previous Christmas. For example, your cell phone has more computer power than all of NASA when they put two men on the moon back in 1969. And a birthday card that sings happy birthday to you, that birthday card has a chip in it with more computer power than all the Allied forces of 1945. Hitler, Stalin, Churchill would have killed to get that chip that you simply throw away in the garbage. Because of Moore's Law, we physicists can project 10, 15 years into the future with near mathematical precision. And prototypes have already been made of internet glasses, internet lenses, and also even a prototype of an internet contact lens. And so eventually, everyone will have it, and we will live in what is called augmented reality. And so this will be part of life. Everything we see around us will be annotated, footnoted, and we'll love it.
You sure of that?
I'm sure, because how many times have we bumped into somebody and we say, who is this person? Jim, John, Jake, I know this person. In the future, you will know exactly who you are talking to. And if you see an object you don't understand, you'll immediately understand what that object is. And this is going to have a revolutionary effect.
One of the things you write about is how our minds, our brains, might in the future be able to interface with artificial intelligence. I guess I have no idea how that would work.
Well, on several levels, already at Brown University, they've taken stroke victims and put a chip in their brain and connected the chip to a laptop computer. And these individuals who are paralyzed can now read email, write email, surf the web, play video games, guide wheelchairs. Anything you can do on a computer, they can do as well, except they're trapped inside a paralyzed body. And we can also use this to control arms.
Let's back up. So they're having a thought like, move this chair or type this letter. How does that thought get translated into the computer?
What they do is they simply attach a chip into the brain, and then you are allowed to look on a computer screen where the cursor is located. Then it's like riding a bicycle. Painfully, you have to learn that certain thoughts control the movement of the cursor, moving it left, right, up, and down. It takes a while. It takes a few hours. But after a while, by looking at the cursor, you begin to realize that certain thoughts will move the cursor in certain directions. And after a while, you can simply move the cursor in any way to do, for example, crossword puzzles or to play video games. But it does take a while because the architecture of the brain is still not mapped out yet. That'll take many more decades before we have a roadmap, neuron for neuron, and can attach these things directly.
So let me ask you, if you take the kind of focused mind that you're talking about and you take away all the technology and think about what the mind can do, does that make a powerful argument for meditation?
Well, the mind is powerful if it focuses and reduces distractions. And you can increase learning capabilities, but you will have to enhance it using radio and using computers, especially if you get into very complicated things like memory. However, 2 months ago, history was made with a mouse brain. They actually were able to input a memory directly into a mouse. This is the first time in history it's been done. It's something right out of science fiction. What they did was they looked at the hippocampus of a mouse and tape recorded impulses as it learned a task. That's the gateway for memory. All memories first go through the hippocampus. They tape recorded the impulses. Then they gave it a chemical which made the mouse forget the task. Then they took this tape recording, this set of impulses, shot it back into the mouse, and the mouse immediately knew how to do the task. So this is the first time it's been demonstrated that you can actually tape record a memory and then reinsert the memory into a mouse and have the mouse perform the task that it previously forgot. Now, the implications of this are enormous because if all memories go through this hippocampus, this is also how our brain functions. And it means that memories in principle, it hasn't been done, of course, but memories in principle might be tape recorded and then shot right back into your brain or somebody else's brain so that somebody, for example, could learn calculus without having to study too hard.
Well, how do you record a memory? How do you measure a memory? Yeah.
What they've done is, since we do not really understand the architecture of the brain, reverse engineering is still science fiction. What they've done is they've simply taken the impulses that go through this part of the brain, which is the gateway to memories. And you can simply tape record impulses as it goes through the gateway, and then later reinsert the tape recorded message. And in the coming decades, as we get better and better at it, we may actually be able to record whole sequences of memories, like vacations, for example.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michio Kaku. He's a theoretical physicist who's a co-founder of string field theory, and his new book is called Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Now, when you were in high school, and you're kind of famous for this, you built a particle accelerator in your mother's garage. What is a particle accelerator?
Well, it's an atom smasher. The biggest one in the world is much bigger than the one I built in high school. It's 17 miles in circumference, and it creates a mini Big Bang to recreate the conditions of the early universe. What I did when I was 16 years old is I went to Westinghouse. I got 400 pounds of transformer steel, 22 miles of copper wire, and I assembled the 6-kilowatt, 2.3 million electron volt electron accelerator in the garage. When it was finished, I would plug it in. There was this huge crackling sound as I consumed 6 kilowatts of power. I blew out every circuit breaker in the house. All the lights were plunged in darkness. And my poor mom would say to herself, why couldn't I have a son who plays baseball? And for God's sake, why can't he find a nice Japanese girlfriend? What's wrong with him? Why does he build these machines in the garage? Well, I love to build machines. It got me into Harvard, so I can't complain. And that began my career as a physicist.
So you ended up, as a student, being mentored by Edward Teller, Teller being known as the father of the hydrogen bomb. He worked on the Manhattan Project, which developed the atom bomb. When you started studying with him, did you think about going into nuclear weapons development as a career?
Well, he very strongly urged me to go into nuclear weapons design. I was in high school. I was playing with antimatter. Antimatter naturally occurs from a substance called sodium-22. I put antimatter in a magnetic field and photographed the tracks of antimatter. I went to the National Science Fair, and I met Edward Teller. In fact, I was on television with Edward Teller. I didn't have to explain to Edward Teller what antimatter was. He immediately knew what it was. He immediately knew what I was doing, and he offered me a scholarship to Harvard. However, you know, he had an ulterior motive as well. Let's be very frank about this. There's a book written by a New York Times reporter called Star Warriors, and it's about a scholarship that Edward Teller was promoting. I was a recipient of that scholarship. And later it came out that the purpose of the scholarship, in part, was to create a cadre corps of young, bright scientists to propel a Star Wars program. These are young physicists, just like me, who fell under his wing and were shepherded into the weapons program. And when I got my bachelor's degree from Harvard, he made a pitch. He made a very big pitch. I could go to Los Alamos, I could go to Livermore, I could go to MIT, and study nuclear weapons design. Unfortunately for him, I decided that I wanted to work in things that were not so destructive, but perhaps had even more power, and that is an explosion called the Big Bang, which was infinitely more powerful than a hydrogen bomb.
Now, you're Japanese, and your father was born in Japan. Did the fact that atom bombs were used on the country of your father's birth affect your decision at all? I mean, understanding like the destructive power of it and maybe knowing something about all the civilians who were killed?
Well, my parents were actually born in California. However, they were sent back to Japan, which was very common for immigrant families, and they grew up in Japan. They were U.S. citizens, born in California but raised in Japan. And then they came back to California at the wrong time. They came back to California before Pearl Harbor. And when Pearl Harbor hit, there was all this hysteria. And my parents were then locked up and shipped out to a relocation camp along with 110,000 other Japanese Americans. And my parents were citizens, and yet they too were rounded up. And they spent the war years basically locked up behind barbed wire. Now, the fact that the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima had an impact in me, being Japanese Americans. But I said to myself that maybe there's some good out of that can come out of this. Maybe science can liberate us from poverty, disease, oppression, ignorance. And I firmly believe this. I believe that science is the engine of prosperity. And I think that by creating institutions and organizations that promote knowledge and promote understanding, I think I could be part of being in a better world.
Now, among your accomplishments is that you are a co-founder of string field theory. I'm going to ask you to explain what that is in the absolute simplest way possible, simplest and briefest way possible.
Okay, well, Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life chasing after a theory of everything, an equation perhaps no more than 1 inch long that would allow him to, quote, read the mind of God. One theory which would summarize all physical law into a single expression. Well, today we think we have the theory. It's called string theory, very controversial, but we're testing the periphery of it with huge machines like the one in Geneva, Switzerland, the Large Hadron Collider. Now, what I've done is I've taken all the equations of string theory, which fill up an entire volume, a gigantic book of equations, and I've summarized it into one equation, 1 inch long. That's my equation. It's called string field theory. The language of physics is something called field theory. We have magnetic fields, gravitational fields, electric fields. That's the language of physics. But string theory was this hodgepodge of little equations and rules of thumb. And what I decided to do was create a field theory of strings, just like we have a field theory of magnetism, a field theory of electricity, a field theory of gravity. And that's what I did. We can summarize electricity, magnetism, and gravity into equations 1 inch long. And that's the power of field theory. And so I said to myself, I will create a field theory of strings. And when I did it one day, it was incredible, realizing that on a sheet of paper, I can write down an equation which summarized almost all physical knowledge. That was power, the power of mathematics.
If I asked you what the theory is, would I understand your answer?
Well, very simply, that all the subatomic particles, neutrons, protons, quarks, are nothing but musical notes on a tiny rubber band. That when you twang the rubber band, it changes from one frequency to another. So it changes from an electron to a neutrino. And you twang it enough, it can turn into all the subatomic particles we see in the world. So all the subatomic particles that make up our body are nothing but different notes on many, many, many tiny little violin strings, little rubber bands. And that physics is nothing but the laws of harmony of these vibrating strings. Chemistry is nothing but the melodies you can play on these vibrating strings. The universe is a symphony of strings. And the mind of God that Einstein wrote eloquently about for the last 30 years of his life is cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace. That is the mind of God.
How do you know you're right? How do you know the equation is correct?
Well, no matter how beautiful the theory, one irritating fact can dismiss the entire formalism, so it has to be proven. So that's where we hope the Large Hadron Collider, the biggest machine of science ever built, will create what are called sparticles. Sparticles are superparticles. They are partners of ordinary particles. We're made out of the lowest octave of the string. But these little rubber bands have higher octaves. That is, new particles that haven't been seen yet. They're called sparticles, or superparticles for short, and we hope to create them with the Large Hadron Collider. It's still a bet. We physicists are taking bets as to whether or not the Large Hadron Collider is powerful enough to create sparticles. But if it does, that could change the whole landscape of modern physics.
Sounds exciting. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Michio Kaku speaking with Terry Gross. Kaku is a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York. His new book is called Physics of the Future. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.